This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In 15 years, Earth will lose thousands of glaciers every year. New science on peak glacier extinction from Switzerland glaciologist Lander van Schicht. Then off to Australia, where it's over 45 degrees C, 113 in the shade Fahrenheit, and it's burning again. Gazing into the flames with wildfire expert Hamish Clark. More and more buildings lost to wildfires in the United States. We've got Dr. Amanda Carlson on hand. So it's cool to really hot this week on Radio EcoShock. Under the barrage of worry, strange news, and pop-up wars, something really big is happening. Earth is losing glaciers rapidly. There are already funerals for them. A new study finds peak glaciation extinction is coming in the next few decades, depending on how hot and how fast we force the climate. Literally billions of people depend on glaciers, known as the water towers of the world. Can we slow down deglaciation? The paper in Nature Climate Change is Peak Glacier Extinction in the Mid-21st Century. We reached the lead author, Dr. Lander van Schicht, glaciologist at ETH Zurich in Switzerland. From Zurich, Lander van Schicht, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, all.
You say millions of people are attracted to glaciers, even though they are inhospitable places. Some glaciers are revered. What attracts us to these icy giants?
Well, it really depends on the person, but my personal feeling is that it's really the inaccessibility of glaciers. They are located high in the mountains in very remote valleys. You have to walk a very long way to see these icy giants. You have to take a train to reach these glaciers. And at the same time, you know that what you are seeing is transient. It's disappearing. And if you would come back the year afterwards, it would not look the same anymore. So it's really this combination of hard to see, hard to get a feeling about this landscape, and at the same time that it's only temporary, that makes these icy giants really special.
Right. Well, talk to us about the role of glaciers in the water cycle and why they are key for millions of people downstream.
Well, glaciers, they have a unique mechanism. In winter, when it's cold enough and when there is a lot of snow, then they accumulate fresh water in the form of snow that then over time transforms into ice. And then in spring and summer, when it gets warmer, when there is less snow, then glaciers start to melt and producing fresh water. So we call typically our glaciers natural reservoirs. They provide fresh water when people need it, when it's warm, when there is no rain, no snow. Then the glaciers make sure that the rivers are still flowing. So without glaciers, in dry periods, rivers might become dry. And this is especially relevant in very dry regions, like, for example, the Ganges or the Indus Basin in Southeast Asia. There, billions of people depend on the upstream glaciers during the summer months when they provide fresh water that is then used for irrigation, but also for industry and for domestic use.
According to the United Nations, around 10% of the world's land surface is currently covered by around 200,000 glaciers, which store approximately 70% of Earth's fresh water. But do we really know how many glaciers this planet has?
Well, we are constantly scanning the Earth with tens of satellites, and they are monitoring the Earth, and we identify flowing ice using multi-temporal satellite images. And if we identify this flowing ice, then we are sure that this is called a glacier, because the definition of a glacier is it needs to flow. And at the same time, it needs to have a minimum size of 0.01 square kilometers, so it needs to be 1 hectare. So by using satellites over multiple times, we can identify all these locations, all these ice areas that are large enough and flowing, and that we are sure that are glaciers. And so in doing this, we have identified more than 200,000 glaciers at present. However, there are also some regions where there is a lot of ice beneath rocks, beneath debris, and this is much more difficult to identify with satellites. So probably this 200,000, it's a lower limit of the number of glaciers we have, but it's captures the majority of the big glaciers that we are sure of.
Do you include glaciers on Greenland and Antarctica in your study, or would these monster ice fields distort the picture in the rest of the world?
Yeah, they would distort the picture indeed, because they are very large, as you say. They melt, they have different dynamics. So we focus on all glaciers except for Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets. So typically glaciologists, or they focus on the glaciers, or they focus on the ice sheets. And in this study, we focus on all glaciers except for Greenland and Antarctica.
And how do you define peak glacier extinction, and what can we do with this number?
Well, we have modeled every individual of these 200,000 glaciers, and we have identified when each of these 200,000 glaciers would disappear. That means getting too small to be called a glacier anymore, or becoming too small so that the volume is smaller than 1% of its initial volume, its present-day volume. And in doing this, we identify the extinction year for every glacier, and by summing all these glaciers disappearing in an individual year, we then calculated the number of glaciers disappearing on Earth for every year between 2025 and 2100. Then we identified that this pattern showed a peak in the middle of the century. And this peak means that at that time, we lose in 1 year most glaciers of all the time periods. So for example, in a 2.7-degree warming world, we lose 3,000 glaciers every year in the 40s, between 2040 and 2050.
And there is a huge variation in glacier loss. Two glaciated areas plunged down to 40% less mass now than they had in 1960. These are in Central Europe, including the Alps, and Western Canada and USA. On current trends, Glacier National Park in the U.S. will have no coming glaciers in coming decades. Why is ice loss so steep in Europe and Western North America?
Well, these two mountain ranges, they have a lot of very small glaciers at present. And so because of climate change, the mass balance is getting negative, so we're losing mass over time. And these very small glaciers, they have almost no buffer for these high loss rates we will observe in the coming 1, 2, 3 decades. So all these small glaciers, they disappear very soon. And this means that the peak in glacier extinction for example, Western Canada and USA and Central Europe will occur pretty soon, just because all these small glaciers, they disappear within the next 3 decades. So only the medium and larger size glaciers remain, but they are much, much less common. So we only have a few very big glaciers in these mountain ranges that will survive in the second half of the century. On the opposite side, another reason is that these two mountain ranges, they are very sensitive to climate change. So temperature increases not only increase the melt in summer, but also decrease the snowfall in winter. And so this combination makes the glaciers in these mountain ranges also very vulnerable to climate change.
Your new paper includes the cultural significance of glaciers, but on our current emissions and 4 degrees C of warming by 2100, glaciers in Central Europe almost completely disappear, a huge change from all human history. How will this change Europe and Europeans, do you think?
Well, exactly. So thousands, even millions of visitors, they go to glaciers to see these icy giants. And what we see in a 4-degree warming world is that there will only be 20 glaciers remaining in Central Europe. And these 20 glaciers, they will also be only located at the very high peaks of the mountain range. So they will also not be accessible. They will not be reachable with public transport. So it will be not possible anymore for tourists to visit glaciers. So it will change the entire landscape of the Alps, that's for sure. But it will also change the economy and the touristic landscape of the region. So somehow we need to rethink the tourism of the Alps for a future without any glacier.
How about glaciers in the Andes in South America? How are they doing?
They're doing slightly better at the moment. So there are a lot of big, medium to big size glaciers. And what we see for this mountain range, Southern Andes, is that there is a huge difference between a 1.5-degree warming world, the Paris Agreement, and a +4-degree warming world by the end of the century. So depending on the scenario, we could save thousands of glaciers in southern Andes, while for other mountain ranges, the difference between the scenarios is much smaller. So every 0.1 degree temperature change we can prevent will save a lot of glaciers in the Andes. And that's one of the regions where this impact is the highest.
You co-authored and were lead author of several studies of glaciers in Kyrgyzstan, Central Asia. To begin, where are the Tian Shan, the celestial mountains?
The Tian Shan is a very big mountain range in Central Asia. So it covers parts of Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, China, and it has more than 10,000 glaciers. And these glaciers, they extend from 2,000 meters above sea level up to 7,000 meters above sea level. So there is a very diverse landscape of glaciers in Central Asia.
And what is happening with those Central Asian glaciers, and why are scientists like you investigating changes there?
Well, they follow the global trend with mass loss, and mass loss that is increasing over time. So glaciers in Central Asia, they're also getting smaller. We are also losing glaciers in Central Asia. And for that specific region, it's very important for the water availability. So Central Asia is a region where there is precipitation in winter and spring, but where the summers are very dry. So that's really an example of a region where the glaciers are natural reservoirs that store ice in winter, release fresh water in summer. So without glaciers, without these buffers of droughts, rivers might become dry, and this would mean a catastrophe for downstream irrigated areas. The soils, the lands around the mountains in Central Asia is very fertile, but because of the dry climate, it's not possible to do agriculture without irrigation. And the water needed for irrigation is coming from the glaciers. So then you can make the circle. Without glaciers, there is no irrigation, there is no agriculture possible in that area.
Tell us about glacier funerals and the global glacier casualty list.
Well, glaciers, they have a very high cultural value. And these glacier funerals, they are a very good example of that. So since 2019, many different mountain ranges and the people in these mountain ranges, they're organizing funerals, glacier funerals. And that means going up the mountain with tens of people to visit the place where the glacier was located for decades, for thousands of years. And so they're going to these locations to give speeches, both religious speeches, but also speeches by glaciologists, to tell them what the glacier meant for them. So it's really a ceremony to give a final greeting to the disappearing glacier. At the other side, the global glacier casualty list is a list where we aim to remember glaciers. So there is a very big data set where we observe or where we include glaciers that we are sure that are lost over time, and we include them in this list together with stories of these glaciers, with old pictures of these glaciers, to remember them, that we will never lose how they looked like in the past.
Your new assessment doesn't go into one devastating glacial change when Glacial Lake Oostburg floods suddenly and wash away buildings and lives downstream. Are those too short-term for this kind of analysis?
They are short-term, and most important is that to investigate these Glacial Lake Oostburg floods, we need very complex models, so often 3D models where we can really go in detail for specific glaciers. And that's opposite to the more simpler models we used for this study, but that allowed to study 200,000 glaciers. So to go into detail about these natural hazards that are accompanied with retreat of glaciers, we need much more complex and detailed studies on individual glaciers.
Your group finds peak glacier extinction around 2041 if we had kept to the Paris goal of just 1.5 degrees of warming. We expect peak extinction to come even sooner in a hotter future, like 4 degrees C hotter than pre-industrial. But counterintuitively, you find a hotter world delays the extinction line, and an earlier peak is more optimistic. Why is that?
Well, that's because in a more optimistic scenario, we only lose the small glacier. They will be lost in a 1.5 degree already by 2040, and they will also be lost in a 4 degree warming by 2040. But in addition to these small glaciers, we also lose medium-sized glaciers in a 4-degree warming world. So they come on top of the small glaciers, and they are disappearing slightly later than the small glaciers. So combining the small glaciers disappearing anyway and the medium and some large glaciers, we see a shift in the peak towards later times. And the peak is also higher, twice as high as in a 1.5-degree warming world for a 4-degree warming world.
Looking at current fossil fuel investments and build-out, I worry by the end of this century, Earth will heat up to 4 degrees hotter than before the Industrial Age. Suppose we save ourselves and we keep that to 2.7 degrees of warming. What difference would that make to world glaciers?
Well, we see that the impact of limiting to 2.7 instead of 4 would save up to 25,000 glaciers. So it means by the end of the century, we have 25,000 glaciers more left than in a 4-degree warming world. And that makes a huge difference because every individual glacier can be important as a provider of fresh water, as a tourism magnet, as a contributor to sea level rise. So we see that we can save 25,000 glaciers if we can limit the global warming to 2.7 instead of plus 4.
2025 was the United Nations International Year of Glaciers Preservation. Did anything happen?
Well, this year was specifically designed to get more attention to glaciers and the importance of glaciers. So there were a lot of initiatives. There were speeches. There were movie events. There were new research collections with many research from all over the world. So there was much more attention to the glaciers and the importance of them in this specific year, and it was also the start of the decade of climate action for cryospheric science. So I feel that because of the attention, people are more aware now of the impact of climate change on glaciers, and let's hope that this is a very good start to take more action and to save glaciers in the coming years and the coming decades.
Reading this paper, I pick up a sense of personal sadness. Lander, you spent time on these ice giants. How does the chronicle of changes in the ice world make you feel?
Well, I'm really passionate about glaciers, and I try to go as often as possible to glaciers to have a glimpse on these icy mountains. And I feel very sad if I return every year to the same glaciers and you really observe from the first row what we are losing. If you're going to a glacier, you're standing on ice of 10 meters thick. You go the next year again, and you're standing on better. Then this is very sad to see. It's very sad to observe from the first row what exactly we are losing.
What got you studying glaciers? How did you get involved in this cold world?
Well, from when I was young, I started hiking in the mountains, looking at the mountains and at the glaciers. I did my first glacier hike when I was 5 years old, so I got this passion from my parents, probably, that took me to the mountains. And then a bit later on, when I was studying geography, I got the chance to start investigating glacier changes using drones. And that's what made me really passionate and motivated to study the impact of climate change on these glaciers, and not only by monitoring them, by measuring them, with measurement devices with drones, but also by using models like we use now in this new study.
Your group ends the new paper by saying we still have agency. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's because we show how many more glaciers we can save if we limit the warming to 2-degree warming world, which is still possible, to a 2.7-degree warming world, which is following current climate policy promises, and in a 4-degree warming world. So we see that there is a huge difference between these scenarios. So we could save thousands of glaciers the sooner we can limit temperature rise.
What are you studying now, Lander?
Well, we're developing our glacial models further. So far we're using monthly climate forcing data, average monthly temperature and precipitation, to get insights into the mass balance of glaciers. And what we're now trying is to use daily climate forcing data. And this will give us much more details into intra- and inter-annual variability. And we are sure that this will also show an impact and will have an impact on the numbers we're putting forward.
From ETH Zurich, we have been speaking with glacier expert Dr. Lander van Tricht. Among his many papers in the field, Lander is lead author of the December 2025 paper, peak glacier extinction in the mid-21st century. Find links to all the science and news in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Lander, thank you for spending time with us.
You're welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We are divided into two camps, those who personally fear wildfires and those who don't. They should. Fires are popping up in unusual places, unhealthy smoke reaches just about everywhere, and carbon from superfires could speed up climate change. There is more, but that's the short list for why all of us need to get the big picture. We reached the author of a new review. It's called Gazing Into the Flames, A Guide to Assessing the Impacts of Climate Change on Landscape Fire. The lead author is Dr. Hamish Clark. He is senior fellow at the Flare Wildfire Research Group at the University of Melbourne. From Melbourne, Hamish Clark, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much for having me, Alex.
Australia has a lot of fire experts, and there's a good reason for that. Tell us about the recent extreme fire warnings in Australia just recently.
Yeah, there's a bunch of fires burning in Victoria, where I'm normally based, and New South Wales, where I'm currently on holiday visiting family. The ones in Victoria are of particular concern. A number of them are up at the emergency warning level. So that's essentially saying that it's not possible to control them, and so people need to enact their plans and leave the area and, you know, take whatever action they can to protect themselves. So, yeah, it's pretty awful conditions right now. My hometown, close to Melbourne, is forecast of a top temperature of 45 degrees Celsius today, which is pretty much unheard of for that part of Melbourne, although it can get hot. So, yeah, things are quite extreme at the moment.
I think when it comes to sort of adding up the media, the city fires burn into our memory. And for North Americans, it may be the town of Lahaina in Hawaii, 2023, and certainly Los Angeles a year ago. Tell us about the Black Summer fires in your part of the world.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, Australia has a history of fire, as you pointed out. It's got a history going back millions of years, and then it's got tens of thousands of years of indigenous use of fire. But since colonisation, there's been a number of major events, and they've been labelled after the day that they happened. There's, you know, Red Thursday, Black Saturday, Black Friday, Ash Wednesday. And so Black Summer was so big that they said a day couldn't handle it. It had to be a season. And to be honest, it was well longer than a season. This was a series of fires, essentially in the southeast and southwest, and it's worth pausing for a moment to acknowledge Australia's, as you noted in your introduction, a very fire-prone place, a very large place, and a real rich diversity of fire regimes. And so we have massive fires in sparsely populated kind of arid areas, grasslands, savannas. And so sometimes this gets mixed up with the other fires that we have in the southeast and southwest. And they're all, you know, important and interesting for their own reasons. So anyway, the Black Summer fires, predominantly in the east, southeast and southwest, kind of started in September or even earlier than that in some places and worked their way down and kept burning through until we had some heavy rain. I think it was possibly around February. And so they basically burnt an unprecedented area. We hadn't seen this amount of area burnt. We'd never seen this amount of area burnt at high severity. So this is not just the footprint of the fire, but the actual nature of the burning. You know, it's kind of getting up into the crown, the canopy of trees, and, you know, scorching or even consuming that. You know, and it came off the back of really extreme conditions. You know, we had our hottest and driest year on record in 2019, and there'd been, you know, drought in large areas before then. And then we had a series of, you know, kind of terrifyingly, spectacularly dangerous fire weather days. It was just kind of relentless. And the toll was awful too. I think around 33 people died directly as a result of it. Thousands of homes were lost. And as we're increasingly understanding, you know, the indirect effects, things like smoke, I mean, arguably that's a direct effect too, but massive effects of smoke on health. You know, studies have found that hundreds of people died because of the amount of smoke. And, of course, all the other, you know, effects that we care about too on the environment and the economy and cultural values and all those things. So it was a pretty incredible season. And I suppose the kind of the scary footnote to it is, unfortunately, these conditions are expected to become more common.
In your new review, you say landscape fire is a prototypical extreme-driven system. What do you mean?
Yeah, so this is the point some of my co-authors are really keen to make, in that I guess if you take a step back and you look at any kind of environmental phenomenon of interest, you can ask about the kind of statistical behavior of it, if you like. You know, you can draw a bell curve, for example. You know, you measure anything, it often follows this kind of bell-shaped distribution where there's an average and then you kind of values at the extremes on either side, whereas the point they're trying to make with fire is, at least in many systems, it doesn't happen that often. And when it does happen, it's often only a small fire, but then the big fires dominate impacts. So these are relatively rare, but they're relatively large, and they certainly dominate the impacts in terms of area burnt, fire severity, you know, life loss, house loss, and those things. So I guess there's understanding fire in all its forms and all its shapes and sizes. But then there's understandable interest in going to those extremes, you know, and that might be based on extreme weather, extreme dryness, various other factors. So that's what we mean by being a kind of an extreme-driven event.
Would you talk to us about the poleward expansion of fires right up into the formerly frozen tundra and I presume also in the southern hemisphere?
Yeah, this is an interesting area. Again, it's a bit scary and not my area of expertise too, I should say, but essentially, as the globe warms, you know, we're seeing warming happening right throughout it. And if you think about fire as a phenomenon, it's got a few really important kind of environmental drivers or switches, if you like. And they all need to be in the on position to get a fire, right? So you need fuel, you need something to burn. That fuel's got to be dry enough to burn, you know, so rainforests don't typically burn, for example. You need the right weather conditions, you know, it's often that kind of hot, dry, windy day, and then you need an ignition. And so in our more kind of polar regions, the temperatures usually aren't that high, the vegetation's usually not that dry. So as conditions change, unfortunately, we're seeing more fire in those areas. So there's obviously a lot more detail behind that, but essentially that's kind of it. We're seeing some of these switches start to turn on that in the past wouldn't have been on, or they would have been on extremely rarely. You kind of zoom out to the climate system more broadly, some of the most terrifying and spectacular warming has been seen in Arctic regions. You know, we're seeing areas that are, you know, recording 20 degrees above the kind of historical climate average. So, yeah, it's really an area of concern, and you'll often see scientists talking in papers about not just different risk in areas that are currently fire-prone, but, you know, all of a sudden areas that formerly weren't particularly fire-prone are becoming, and so there's obviously a lot that they need to do to start thinking about and preparing for those conditions where they potentially didn't have as much experience of doing so in the past.
A 2025 study led by Saeed Saidi found, quote, the population directly exposed to wildland fires increased 40% globally from 2002 to 2021, despite a 26% decline in burned area, end quote. So more people are moving into fire risk zones. When you weigh impacts, how does that demographic factor compare to climate drivers? Is it possible to even sort them out?
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting area and an important area. And I think increasingly it will be possible to sort those out. I mean, in a sense, it's kind of obvious. If we build houses in areas that are known to be fire prone, then, you know, there's a risk that we're exposing ourselves to. And, you know, this is the pattern of development in large areas of the world. You know, we start small and then we work our way out. And it's often that interface, you know, it's sometimes called the wildland-urban interface or WUI, although it doesn't mean the same thing to people in Australia. But it's essentially where the bush or the vegetation meets people. So, yeah, it's definitely a factor. You know, there's a different kind of risk compared to fires that are happening in more remote areas or fires that are happening in more urban areas, tend to be kind of house or building fires rather than kind of vegetation driven. People are trying to understand what can we do to reduce the risk and what are the factors, how much of it comes from, let's say, the bush or the vegetation, how much of it comes from how we're building our homes and designing our settlements, things like that. So yeah, I haven't seen too many attempts to kind of try and partition out, you know, this much from the climate, this much from dryness, this much from development at the interface. But those kinds of studies are becoming more common. And in fact, one of my co-authors on this paper, Francesca De Giuseppe, is one of the leaders of a big fire mapping project called State of Wildfires, where they are literally trying to look at major events like the LA fires, big Canadian fires the previous year, and ask, okay, well, how much of this do we think was weather-driven, dryness-driven, some other factors? So, yeah, that modelling is certainly developing, and it does help us to think through the drivers of risk and the contributions that they're making, but it's certainly complex.
We will be right back with Hamish Clark on World Wildfires.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We return to Gazing in the Flames, a review of world wildfires in a hotter world. Our guest is Dr. Hamish Clark, from the University of Melbourne in Australia.
Well, you have to have an ignition source to have a fire, and it could be a downed power line, a car fire, or arson. But the largest fires with the biggest carbon consequences, I think, seem to come from wildlands after being set on fire by lightning. And some studies suggest lightning will increase in the, well, at least in some regions as the world warms. How do you see the role of lightning in future wildfires?
Yeah, it's a huge X factor. Up until, you know, maybe 3 to 5 years ago, there'd been extremely few studies of this. I think it may be a combination of improvements in climate modelling where we're able to kind of include more and have less that's just kind of a simple, you know, assumption or parameterisation. We're starting to get some of the dynamics of the drivers of lightning. I think as more research comes out, I've seen probably more predicting an increase than a decrease, but it's certainly not uniform. And as you rightly pointed out, there's going to be important spatial variations and no doubt seasonal variations. But yeah, lightning has historically been the major cause of fire until humans came along and started setting fires. And then in this day and age, again, as you pointed out, you know, we start fires in all kinds of weird and wonderful and often accidental ways. So those human-caused fires tend to understandably cluster around human settlements, around infrastructure, you know, power lines and roads. And so there's potentially a different set of, you know, research questions and management options and tactics. Lightning is a bit harder to control, and some of the biggest fires, this goes for black summer fires, but, yeah, all around the world are actually lightning-driven and they're essentially uncontrollable, so we are very much vulnerable to changes in those patterns. And of course, the dry lightning is the key, is when it happens and it's not accompanied by a huge amount of rain. And then if the landscape is primed for fire, if it's been dry, for example, that's when those, you know, lightning ignitions can lead to fires that end up becoming big and hard to control.
In your review, though, you take care not to demonize all fires as only a threat to humans. Do you want to just talk quickly about how humans and natural systems use fire beneficially?
Yeah, I can give it a crack. I mean, one of the really rewarding things about working in fire is how diverse and complex it is, and it touches on so many strands of human knowledge and, you know, many scientific disciplines, but of course many things outside science. And, you know, I personally think it's really rewarding but also important to stress that, because if we're not careful, we can kind of slip back into probably more simplistic views, you know, fire is the enemy, we need to destroy it and fight it. And to some extent, that's true in some locations and places, but our relationship with fire goes back much further and is much richer than that. And particularly here in Australia, as I mentioned, you know, we've got this incredible record of oldest living continuous cultures on Earth, settlements 60,000 or more years, incredible diversity, right? So changes from region to region, you know, Aboriginal nation to nation. They were using fire to care for country. They weren't looking at fire through a risk lens, although their practices probably did decrease risk. It was about, you know, biocultural landscapes and about listening to country, relating to country, using fire. So a really different way of relating to the environment and to fire, to what we're used to. But it's also finally receiving a bit more recognition. There's kind of cultural burning units cropping up in environment departments. There's a lot of conversation, a lot of research, a lot of practice. Legislative changes, you know, are afoot. And so I guess a little bit of a renaissance in that is really encouraging. And I think, you know, more broadly, it's always important to include and recognise different kinds of knowledge, and that goes for Indigenous knowledge, but also operational knowledge, which doesn't always get written up in papers, and the lived experience of communities too. There are many other kind of human and cultural uses of fire too, you know, the kind of classic campfire. There's some that are more, I guess, harmful, you could argue, in terms of deforestation fires happening in tropical areas. And often these are kind of, you know, economically driven, people trying to make a living. But a lot of deforestation is associated with fire as well. Not my area of expertise, but there's certainly a very wide range of human uses of fire. Probably would just quickly end by pointing out to a, you know, pretty significant operational use of fire, and that's prescribed burning. Also not without its, you know, complexity and controversy, but a really important part of current fire management practices.
Your team says, quote, "The consequences of climate change will lead to fire activity that exceeds the limits of suppression resource capacity. In other words, fires too big to fight. If fires become more extreme, partly because of climate change, does that suggest maybe international cooperation to fight fires may become as necessary as military alliances?"
Yeah, look, those cooperation and interagency kind of exchanges are already happening and have been for some time. So I'm most familiar with exchanges between Australia and North America, but I've got no doubt there are other ones. I think people coming to New Zealand, South Africa possibly, and, you know, no doubt there's others that I'm not aware of. So yes, this certainly is an issue. And, you know, for a country as big as Australia, there's regular flux of people, you know, throughout the regions and the states and territories as well. So I've got no doubt that this is going to be an active area of development and growth. We can throw more resources at things, you know, we can throw more tools, you know, planes, techniques, but, you know, the whole point of suggesting that they're beyond our capacity to suppress is, you know, at least temporarily, that's just the case, you know, and that's what's happening with emergency fires. You know, we can do some things, we can certainly try and protect life and property, but we really can't, you know, control everything that the fire is doing. It's really serious and it's a cause for concern and requires, you know, planning and kind of long-term thinking about how we can set up ourselves and the kind of towns and homes and regions that we live in to be as resilient as possible to these increases in risk. Obviously, it would be nice if we actually took much stronger and much more urgent action against climate change, you know, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, fossil fuel burning, etc. Fire is complex enough as it is without increasing the risk through climate change.
From what we know so far, Hamish, do you think there are tipping points in fire behavior?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, for listeners who aren't familiar with that term, tipping points has been floating around for a while in the context of climate change projections and impact assessments. We're probably all familiar with gradual change. You know, we all get taller gradually. I'm getting balder gradually. But many changes in life can be much more sudden. There seems to be no change at all, and then all of a sudden there's a big change. So with climate change, you know, we're looking at changes in temperature and rainfall and various other, you know, aspects of the climate system. But there's also some aspects that might change more radically. You know, changes in, you know, ocean circulation, ice and glacier loss kind of accelerating. Not my area of expertise, but basically it's an active area of interest is these kind of major sudden changes rather than the more gradual ones. And, you know, the fact that they're major and sudden means even if we decide there's a relatively small chance of them happening, we really need to think through what the consequences would be of them happening because they're so major. And so in terms of fire, I guess there's a few kind of examples that come to mind. You know, maybe the simplest one is just an escalation in fire behaviour where we have an increasing amount of fires that are just not possible to control. And certainly, you know, that can wear down people, wear down systems, wear down firefighters, communities. You often see tipping points in the context of vegetation change. So there's this really useful concept of a fire regime, sometimes called a fire regime niche or a pyro region. There's probably a handful of other terms, but it's essentially a patch of landscape, a certain kind of vegetation, but also a certain kind of fire, a certain flavour of fire. And wherever you or your listeners are locally, you'll probably know a lot about your local fire regime. Or in your local, you know, forests, grasslands, wherever you are. So this normal kind of fire is referring to how often it happens, how big they tend to be, are they kind of, you know, grassy or woody fuel. And it includes the normal extremes, if you'll pardon the expression. So you might get a normal fire once every 5 or 10 years, but a big extreme one once every, you know, 20 to 50 years, for example. So this idea of a fire regime, and so if you think about tipping points with fire, what if the fire regime changes? What if the vegetation all of a sudden shifts from forest to a grassland? Obviously, that's going to radically change, you know, all of the properties of the fire regime, from, you know, frequency to intensity to the rest of it. You know, if vegetation is burnt too frequently to recover, then, you know, it will change. You know, different kinds of vegetation will crop up. But I think we've already seen changes in vegetation. I don't know how confident we are that they're all being fire-driven compared to, you know, other pressures, you know, human activities, climate, etc. But I think that's, yeah, a significant cause for concern, is kind of a change in the fire regime, which then, you know, makes it much harder to predict what's going to happen. I guess there's another, going back to an earlier part of our conversation, where areas that weren't fire-prone are becoming fire-prone. You could think of that as a kind of tipping point. And then, I don't know if you were going to ask about this later, but we allude in the paper to kind of permafrost and areas that are kind of thawing and melting, and, you know, we have this kind of fascinating phenomenon of overwintering fires, but basically areas that are kind of frozen or otherwise very generally impervious to fires or resistant to fires, all of a sudden fire coming in and changing things, you know, potentially releasing a large amount of carbon in the process. So there's a number of them, and I think it's probably fair to say we're still getting our heads around exactly how severe they are and where they are and how likely they are.
Yes, we just got news in British Columbia. There are at least a dozen wildfires still burning, some under the snow, and they're expected to come up again in the spring. So some of them are surviving. And there's a new factor in fire impact, and that's really political retrogression. I mean, the United States, they're shutting down research into better fire prediction. They're reducing national support for fire prevention and firefighting and even public aid after a terrible fire. That's happening in the United States. How about Australia and other countries?
Yeah, look, thankfully, no, I would say. I'd say there's still pretty good support for fire management research, you know, research into biodiversity and various other aspects. You'd always like to see more, but I understand we're operating in a resource-constrained environment. There's many other hazards. You know, we have heat waves, we have floods, we have tropical cyclones. But broadly speaking, I would say there's still a reasonable consensus across the political spectrum and across society that we need to be investing in management of natural hazards, in research into them. One area I think we probably need to invest more in is recovery. You know, I have some colleagues working in this area, and it seems that a lot of the focus is on the immediate aftermath of an incident, which is understandable, first 24 hours or 72 hours. But we know hazards, you know, major fires and other events can impact people for decades. You know, we're looking at impacts on physical health, mental health, relationships, education, employment, so many things. Often the instinct, it seems, is to go and rebuild a bridge or a road and kind of declare the recovery or the repair done, rebuild a house, for example. But it's much more complex than that. And unfortunately, as we're seeing, you know, compound hazards, cascading hazards, you know, a flood one year, a flood the next, maybe a fire the one after that. And as they increase in intensity and, you know, extreme, then it's really important that we think about how we look after our communities, our frontline workers, firefighters, emergency management responders, community social services, all those things. So I would say, you know, we're very privileged in Australia, relatively speaking. It obviously depends where you are and who you are. We still have, unfortunately, reasonable levels of poverty. We still have marginalised communities, particularly Indigenous communities. But overall, we're in a relatively strong position, and hopefully we can use that to kind of keep pushing for the important work that needs to be done across the spectrum.
As we wrap this up, what are you working on now?
Yeah, right now I was lucky enough to get what's called an industry fellowship from our national research funding body, the Australian Research Council. So it's an amazing opportunity to work for the next 4 years. I'm 6 months into it, so the next 3.5 years, with the lead fire management agencies in Victoria and in Australia. They are really, this is the Department of Energy, Environment and Climate Action, DECA, and the Country Fire Authority, CFA. And we've also got the National Natural Hazards Funding Body, Natural Hazards Research Australia, on board as a partner too. So I'm working closely with them. I've got a postdoc working with me, Marikara Bonza, I've got a PhD student, Luana Tsikupa-Borges, working with me, another RA, Caitlin Simon, and another RA, Amelia French. So what we're really interested in is how effective fire management is at the moment and how resilient it is to climate change. So we're particularly interested in understanding the operational reality. So we really want these to be co-designed research, you know, deeply informed by the knowledge and priorities in agencies, and trying to find out where we can add value. You know, some areas are reasonably well researched. I wouldn't say we're out of questions, but something like prescribed burning, there's been quite a lot of research on. Hasn't been as much on suppression. There's been very little compared to that on community engagement. So we're really interested in across the spectrum of kind of the response to emergencies and disasters, what works, you know, what's going to work in a hotter, more extreme world, and where can we kind of direct resources to increase effectiveness. So yeah, very interested in the kind of that applied research of understanding climate change impacts on fire management. I've just been chatting with Mike Flanagan, who was one of my co-authors on this paper, who helped me kind of dream it up, and we've actually decided to do something similar, but specifically looking at climate change impacts on fire management. And so it's possible this time next year I'd be ready to have another conversation along these lines about that paper. Beyond that, I've got lots of other interests. You know, I love working across disciplines and sectors. Fire and climate change are good places to do that. There's already pretty good connections, but I think we can do a lot better, particularly bringing in things like the humanities and the law. And I'm also personally quite interested in creative approaches to communication. So, you know, cartoons and design and different ways of bringing different stakeholders together, growing understanding, working with students, community members, and things like that. So they're some of the things that I'm privileged to spend my time on.
From the FLAIR Wildlife Research Group, University of Melbourne, we've been speaking with Dr. Hamish Clark. Find links to all the science and news we just talked about in my weekly show blog at Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Hamish, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks very much for having me, Alex. All the best.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's not your imagination. More of the United States burned in recent decades, and more buildings too. Rising insurance rates tell the tale, if you can get insurance. This is no surprise in a hotter world, but as always, humans complicate the picture. Scientists are racing to grasp and predict wildfire threat. Let's get the facts. Amanda Carlson is lead author of the new study, Rising Rates of Wildfire Building Destruction in the Conterminous United States. Dr. Carlson is a physical research scientist with the Geosciences and Environmental Change Science Center. From Denver, Colorado, Amanda Carlson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
It seems like fires are more intense and going where they never go before. Is that just more media coverage, sensationalism, or has the American experience with fire been different in this young century?
Yeah, so a lot of research over the last several years have shown that wildfires are increasing, particularly in the northwestern U.S., particularly in western forests. Our study looked at the rate of building destruction from wildfires and how that's changed from 2002 to 2022. So our main finding from the study was that the rate of destruction has significantly increased over the past two decades.
What I find strange about that is, and you say this in the paper, that global burned areas have decreased since the late 20th century. Why should we be concerned about wildfire impacts if burned areas are on the decline?
So it's not just a matter of how much area burns. So first of all, those global trends are a little bit complicated when you look at more regional trends. So as I mentioned earlier, we're not necessarily seeing increases in burned area across all of the U.S., but particularly in the western forested regions, we have been seeing significant increases. And it's also a matter of how wildfires behave, how intensely they burn, how quickly they spread.
Okay, so now this next is a huge subject, but could you introduce us to some of the ways climate change contributes to more wildfires or more damaging wildfires in the U.S.?
So in regions where we've had a lot of frequent fire in the past, like in the southwest United States, we have climates that are suited for wildfire, so not necessarily that we're getting more burned area, but we can get more extreme droughts. more extreme weather conditions that can result in more extreme fire behavior. And the data over the past few years has shown wildfires are spreading at faster rates and growing larger, burning at higher intensities. And then at the same time, in regions that are colder and wetter, where fires have historically been more limited by climate, we see a more frequent occurrence of conditions that can lead to large fires, and particularly in areas where you have a lot of fuels, like really dense forests, that can lead to really high-intensity fires.
A long-standing question raised by several studies, are damages increasing because more people move into fire-prone zones, and or has poor fire management contributed? Can your new study add more certainty about what is driven by social change and what by climate-induced forces?
Yeah, so we know that the wildland-urban interface is increasing in area. We know more home development compounds how many people are exposed to wildfires when they occur. So a combination of more fire, more intensely burning fires, and more people in the UI is definitely something that's exacerbating wildfire problem. However, a key finding of this study was that the increase in building destruction over the last two decades is not necessarily just because the number of buildings exposed to fires have increased. We actually found that the rate of destruction, or the number of buildings that are destroyed relative to each building that's exposed, is what's increased most dramatically. So that would potentially indicate that it's not so much a matter of building more into fire-prone areas as it is that the fires are just becoming harder to control and communities are becoming more vulnerable.
In two of the most costly fire zones, the Western United States and Eastern Australia, Aboriginal people say they previously used fire itself selectively as a management tool. Is there a case for applying more Aboriginal knowledge to growing fire threats? What are your thoughts?
I mean, definitely that's an area that is of growing interest. I think there's a growing recognition that these forests, these sagebrush ecosystems, shrubland ecosystems have been managed for a long time by Indigenous fire, and there's definitely a need to apply more fire to the landscape, more treatments, both in terms of cultural burning, intentional prescribed fire, mechanical fuel treatments, and grazing and things like that. These are all things that can be effective in reducing hazardous fuel loads.
Well, we know one urban fire can leave ecological and human scars possibly for decades, and it seems fire is an event-driven driver rather than a gradual phenomenon like rising seas, but it seems some climate models don't handle quick, fast events that then disappear as well as they do averages of things. So are the models, in your opinion, keeping up with what's happening on the ground with wildfires?
I think models can give us an idea of the frequency of weather conditions that would lead to large extreme fires. Modeling individual fires is a very difficult process, though. There's a lot of randomness in terms of day of weather, where ignitions occur, and whether ignitions occur close to communities that are vulnerable.
Former Governor Ronald Reagan famously said fire season is now all year in California, and we know the length of fire season per se has increased. Is that because of climate change, and are you seeing that in your studies?
So a lot of the most destructive fires that we looked at in our data set have occurred outside of the fire season. So where I am in Colorado, we had the Marshall Fire, which occurred over New Year's in 2021. So that was definitely something that occurred outside of the typical fire season and was one of the most destructive events we've had in Colorado history. And that said, you can't necessarily attribute single weather events to climate change.
Los Angeles required basic fire protection around homes. They call it a defensible space. And there are things we can do. Do you want to talk to us about that?
Yeah, so one thing we plan to do with the data set we built, we're mapping locations of building loss. We want to be able to take a more detailed look at what spatial factors are influencing the probability of buildings surviving versus being destroyed. So defensible space, I think we know from individual case studies that that's been an important factor in the past. So we hope to gain a better understanding of that. Broadly speaking, in this study, we looked at types of vegetation, and we found that higher proportions of forest vegetation specifically contribute to higher likelihoods of destruction, so that could have potential implications for management.
So is wildfire just a worry for Americans living in the West? Because just recently we saw some fires in New Jersey, which were unexpected, one in New York City. What would we say to our Eastern listeners?
I'd say the occurrence of destructive fires is definitely less common in the East than in the West. However, one of the things we looked at in this study was how the vegetation affects the likelihood of destruction. And what we found in the few destructive fires we did see in the eastern U.S. was that a lot of these communities are built with a lot of wildland-urban interface and a lot of forest vegetation. So those events do have the potential to be highly destructive. And in fact, one of the most destructive fires that we mapped in our data set was the Chimney Tops fire in eastern Tennessee in 2016. So the combination of a lot of forest vegetation and a lot of populations living in proximity to forests does create the potential for really destructive events if you have the right weather conditions.
Your study period ended before the January 2025 urban fires in Los Angeles. Do you think that would fit in with what you found, or is that possibly something new?
Yeah, so that would have been pretty interesting to look at, because one of the main findings of this study was that one of the most important drivers for increasing rates of building destruction was the fact that more destructive fires have been occurring in forests, particularly in Northern California, Oregon, and Washington. But at the same time, we did see that the majority of buildings destroyed by fire are in grassland and shrublands, like we saw in Los Angeles in the 2025 fires. And we saw the rate of destruction in those ecosystems increasing over time. So it's those dual factors that fires in forests are more destructive and we're having more of them, but also that fires in grass and shrublands are becoming more destructive as well, driven by more extreme fire weather conditions. So I think looking at the Los Angeles fires would have probably highlighted that finding that destruction rates are increasing in grass and shrublands as well.
Amanda, what are you working on these days?
I'm hoping to dive deeper into this data set we created, looking at more detailed models of risk and trying to understand factors that affect community vulnerability.
From the U.S. Geological Survey in Denver, our guest is Amanda Carlson. We discussed her new paper, Rising Rates of Wildfire Building Destruction in the Conterminous United States. Find links to the science and news we just talked about in my show blog, Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Amanda, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into the news from the now unnatural world. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Join us again next week.